Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host again for this edition. A little over a week ago, I posted on Facebook that I was unsure what to think of what I described as the Russia-USA conflict taking place in the Ukraine. I did not in any way attempt to justify the Russian invasion, nor make excuses for Putin, but I did note that certain of Russia's grievances, namely the eastward expansion of NATO, had some legitimacy, and I noted that the U.S. has some serious culpability. I also observed that what many credible media outlets have been documenting for several decades, or at least a decade rather, that there is a contingent of white nationalists within the Ukrainian government. This is a known fact, only disputed by people who just haven't been paying attention or who would prefer to deny the ugly truth. Does that mean that the Ukraine is a neo-fascist state, as Putin claims? No more so than the U.S. is neo-fascist due to the presence of white nationalists like Louis Gohmert and Matt Gaetz and Lauren Boebert in our legislature, or governors like Abbott in Texas or Ducey in Arizona. These are unfortunate and obscene blemishes on our national character, but neo-fascist so far is a political direction people like that are hoping to push us toward, and not yet a present reality under which we suffer. I got a lot of support from my post, with some calling it reasoned, calm, insightful, but also some harsh pushback with people, even friends who I thought I knew well, accusing me of parroting unconscionable pro-Putin rhetoric. Jeff Cohen of Roots Action and formerly with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has noticed that trend as well, and he wrote about it in a recent tweet about how there's essentially an orthodoxy and a prime narrative preferred by the state department and reinforced by the majority of media outlets, a kind of a Putin bad, Ukraine innocent, and U.S. to the rescue portrait that if you deviate from that script, even just to ask a question, you get blasted and denounced as cooperating with the enemy. Cohen, who worked at a major media outlet during the build-up to the U.S. war on Iraq, noted the glaring similarities with that terrible episode. Well, here in the community radio world, and in Pacifica in particular, we have an obligation to ask the uncomfortable questions and challenge popular assumptions. I know no one in any branch of journalism aside from official Russian spokespeople who are justifying the Russian invasion. I know of no one who sees Putin as a hero or even as right. But it seems that for some, no matter how boldly you preface any statement questioning the Ukraine conflict in any way, with declarations of unequivocal objection to the Russian invasion, and I'll say it here again, the invasion is wrong, it's a crime, it must be stopped, and it cannot be forgiven, that some folks will turn on you like a pack of starving hyenas if they even think you might not be fully on board with the preferred program. Well, here are some examples of the kinds of questions folks are asking, and which I have and will continue to articulate here. To what extent was the U.S. involvement in the coup in the Ukraine in 2014 responsible for precipitating the current crisis? Has the Ukrainian regime, as Putin claims, brutally attacked the Russia-identified eastern provinces, provoking Russia to defend them? Or, as the West claims, are the eastern provinces under Russian control and, much like the U.S.-controlled Contras in Nicaragua, a kind of a proxy army whose purpose is to destabilize the nation? Given that there are neo-Nazi organizations that hold civil authority within the Ukrainian government, if we give Ukraine arms, are we in effect in part arming Nazis? In Syria, we armed the Al-Qaeda-associated factions, so it wouldn't exactly be unprecedented. How legitimate is Russia's concern about NATO's eastward expansion? Last week's show examined some of these questions, but mainly by reposing them. In today's show, we have a recent talk by Professor John Mearsheimer, who's a vocal critic of the U.S. and Western countries' role in the U.S. or in Eastern Europe. And although I do need to point out that, like nearly all of us, he too is not in favor of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
Professor John Mearsheimer is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science at the University of Chicago, where he has taught since 1982. He graduated from West Point in 1970 and then served 5 years as an officer in the US Air Force. He has published 6 immensely influential books, principally on international relations theory, the most recent of which was The Great Delusion, Liberal Dreams and International Realities. In 2020, Professor Mearsheimer won the James Madison Award, which is given once every 3 years by the American Political Science Association to an American political scientist who has made a distinguished scholarly contribution to political science. Professor Mearsheimer, it is an honor to have you with us today. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's a great pleasure to be here. I wish I was not here virtually, but that I was physically at Cambridge. I'd actually love to come to Cambridge sometime and talk to you and to meet people, go to lunch, go to dinner, and so forth and so on. I understand these virtual talks are a good second best, but nevertheless, they are second best. Tom asked me to talk for about 20 minutes on the whole subject of the Ukraine crisis, which I, of course, have written about and talked about extensively since 2014. So I'm happy to do that, and I'll answer questions on Ukraine, and I'm willing to answer questions on almost any subject you folks would like to talk about. Let me do two things. First, let me talk about the origins and the history of this crisis, and then talk about why it's on the front burner today. And then let me say a few words in conclusion about where we're headed. The conventional wisdom in the West, and this is certainly true in a place like Britain and the United States, is that Putin is responsible for this crisis. It's the Russians. They're good guys and bad guys. And of course, we are the good guys and the Russians are the bad guys. This is simply wrong. The United States mainly, but the United States and its allies are responsible for this crisis, not Putin and Russia. Now, why do I say that? Very important to understand that what the West has been trying to do since 2008 is turn Ukraine into a Western bulwark on Russia's border. And that policy had three dimensions to it. The first and most important is NATO expansion. The idea was that we were going to expand NATO eastward to include Ukraine. The second element of the strategy was EU expansion. So in other words, it was not just NATO expansion that was going to go and include Ukraine. It was also EU expansion. And the third element of the strategy was the color revolution. And in the case of Ukraine, that was the Orange Revolution. And the idea was to turn Ukraine into a liberal democracy like Britain, like the United States. And not only a liberal democracy, but a liberal democracy that was allied with the United States. Because again, this is all part and parcel of a strategy that is designed to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's border. Now, as I said to you, the most important element of the strategy is NATO expansion. And that's why the April 2008 Bucharest NATO summit is of immense importance. At the end of that April 2008 Bucharest summit, NATO announced that Georgia and Ukraine would become part of NATO. They said, this is going to happen, period. The Russians made it unequivocally clear at that point that that is not going to happen. They drew a line in the sand. As you all know, there were two big tranches of NATO expansion before that 2008 meeting. The first tranche of NATO expansion was in 1999. That included Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. Then there was a second tranche in 2004, which included countries like Romania and the Baltic states and so forth and so on. The Russians swallowed those two NATO expansions. They intensely disliked both of them, but they swallowed them. when NATO said in 2008 that expansion would now include Georgia and Ukraine, the Russians drew a line in the sand. It's very important to understand that. They said, this has not happened. It is no accident that in August of 2008, a few months after the April 2008 Bucharest summit, you had a war between Russia and Georgia. Remember, Georgia is the other country besides Ukraine that is going to be brought into NATO. The Russians said, that ain't happening. And you had a war in August 2008. In February 22nd, 2014, the crisis broke out over Ukraine. And it was mainly precipitated by a coup in Ukraine that overthrew a pro-Russian leader and installed a pro-American leader. The United States was involved in that coup. The Russians went ballistic. This is hardly surprising. They went ballistic and they did two things. First is they took Crimea from Ukraine. Why did they do that? You understand that there is a very important naval base called Sevastopol on Crimea. And there's no way the Russians are going to let Sevastopol become a NATO naval base. This is not going to happen. That's the principal reason that the Russians took Crimea. And the second thing that they did is that the Russians took advantage of a civil war that broke out in eastern Ukraine almost immediately after the February 22nd, 2014 crisis. And what the Russians have done is they have fueled that civil war and they have made sure that their allies, who are mainly Russian speakers and in many cases Russian, in eastern Ukraine are not defeated by the Ukrainian government. They, in effect, are wrecking Ukraine. The Russians are basically saying, we will wreck Ukraine before we allow Ukraine to become a member of NATO. So the Russian response is very important to understand this. In 2014, when the crisis first broke out into the open in response to what had happened in Bucharest in 2008, the Russian response was twofold. Number one, they took Crimea. And you should all understand Crimea is gone. It is never going back to Ukraine. One. And number two, they have said implicitly that we will destroy Ukraine. We will wreck it before we will let it become a member of NATO. Now, the question you want to ask yourself is, why are the Russians doing this? This is Realpolitik 101. And the fact that people in the West, especially in places like Britain and the United States, don't understand this boggles my mind. I just don't understand it. The idea that you could take a military alliance run by the United States, the most powerful state in the world, and run it up to Russia's borders, and the Russians wouldn't be bothered by it, is simply unthinkable. We in the United States have the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine says that no distant great power is allowed to form a military alliance with a country in the Western Hemisphere and is certainly not allowed to move military forces into the Western Hemisphere. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis very well. What happened there is the Soviets put nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba. The United States said, this is categorically unacceptable. Military forces from afar are not allowed in the Western Hemisphere. And we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the end result is those missiles were removed. when the Soviets were later talking about building a naval base at Cienfuegos, the United States told them in no uncertain terms, you are not building a naval base at Cienfuegos. Just not going to happen. The United States views the Western Hemisphere as its backyard, and it prohibits distant great powers from coming into its backyard. Well, don't you think the Russians are going to be deeply disturbed by the United States turning Ukraine into a bulwark right on its borders? Of course they are. And the Russians told us that immediately after the Bucharest summit. The Russians made it categorically clear that Ukraine is not going to become part of NATO. But of course, the Americans and their allies did not listen because we believe that we're the good guys. We're a benign hegemon here in the United States, and we can do pretty much anything we want in the world. And for a while, it looked like we could get away with that. As I said, the Russians accepted the first NATO expansion, the 1999 one, and they accepted the second NATO expansion. But after Bucharest, they said, this is not happening. So you had this major crisis that broke out in February 2014. Now, the crisis tamped down quite a bit after 2014. But in the fall of last year, 2021, it began to ramp up. And of course, early this year, and I'm talking about early 22, it became a full-blown crisis. And the question that we want to ask ourselves is, what happened here? You know, why all of a sudden did this crisis go from the back burner to the front burner? And the answer is that the United States and its allies were effectively turning Ukraine into a de facto member of NATO. You'll hear lots of rhetoric today that the Russians really had nothing to worry about because nobody is talking about making Ukraine a member of NATO today. And I think that's true. But if you look at what we were actually doing, it's a different story. First of all, going back to the Trump administration and continuing into the Biden administration, we are now arming Ukraine. We were not arming Ukraine during the Obama administration. In February 2014, when the crisis broke out, and in the first few years after that crisis, when the Obama administration was in power, we refused to arm the Ukrainians because we knew it would enrage the Russians. It would scare the Russians. You want to understand that the Russians view Ukraine becoming a part of NATO as an existential threat. That's what's going on here. The Russians are sending a very clear message to the West. They're telling you, we take this threat seriously, and we are willing to use military force, if necessary, to eliminate this threat. The Russians are not fooling around here. So what you had happening in 2021, and of course, it started before that under the Trump administration, is we were arming the Ukrainians. And when you start talking about arming the Ukrainians, those are Ukrainian forces that can fight against Russia's allies in eastern Ukraine. One thing that really spooked the Russians was that the Turks gave the Ukrainians drones. And drones have become a very effective weapon on the battlefield, as the Azerbaijanis proved against the Armenians last year. And the Azerbaijanis were using Turkish drones. So the Turks are giving drones. The Americans and the British are giving all sorts of other weapons to the Ukrainians. You know, of course, that we define these weapons as defensive weapons But of course, as sophisticated IR theorists, you all know that there's no such thing as a meaningful distinction between defensive weapons and offensive weapons. As we all know from the security dilemma, what looks defensive to us looks offensive to them. You give drones to the Ukrainians. Do you think the Russians are going to view those as defensive weapons? I don't think so. Right? You start training the Ukrainian forces the way the British and the Americans do. You don't think the Russians are going to see that as a threat? I can guarantee you they are, right? So what's happening here? We're arming, we're training the Ukrainians. And if you look at how we're dealing with Ukraine diplomatically, we're basically talking about Ukraine as if it were an ally or a partner. That's the kind of rhetoric we use when we talk about Ukraine. So it looks like diplomatically and militarily, the bonds between the West, especially the United States, and Ukraine are tightening. At the same time, we're doing a number of provocative things outside of Ukraine that really bother the Russians enormously. The British foolishly run a destroyer through Russian territorial waters in the Black Sea this past summer, June 2021. The Americans take a bomber and they drive it right up against the Russian coastline in the Black Sea. This really bothers the Russians, unsurprisingly. So what you see happening here is the Russians have a very powerful sense that NATO is moving eastward. NATO is moving right up to the Russian border, mainly by turning Ukraine into a de facto member of the alliance, but also with provocative measures like this British destroyer and this American bomber. The Russians, as Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, said, reached a boiling point. They had it. They're not interested really in negotiating anymore. They're interested in altering the status quo. And the end result is you've had this massive military buildup, which is doing enormous damage to the Ukrainian economy, which was already a basket case before the crisis. So Ukraine's situation is getting worse and worse. And the Russians have sent a very clear signal to the West that if they up the ante, they meaning the West, if the West ups the ante, the Russians will up the ante. And again, Ukraine is not becoming a part of NATO. So that's where we are today. We have this major crisis, which goes back really to April 2008. That's the genesis, that decision to make Ukraine part of NATO. And then you had the crisis break out 22 February 2014. And over time, it was ameliorated somewhat, pushed to the back burner, I think one could say. And then all of a sudden, it broke out again. Now, is there any hope that we can settle this crisis? I'll tell you what I think the best solution is. I think it's an obvious solution, but I think it's politically unacceptable at this point in time. The obvious solution is to turn Ukraine into a neutral state, more or less a buffer between Russia on one side and NATO on the other. This is effectively what you had up until February 2014. Ukraine got its independence when the Soviet Union broke apart in December 1991. And from December 1991 until roughly early 2014, there was no real problem with Ukraine. The United States and its allies were not fighting with the Russians over Ukraine. There was a verbal dispute going back to the April 2008 Bucharest summit, but there was no crisis because Ukraine from 2013 was effectively a neutral state. It was a buffer. It was NATO that changed the situation. You understand, we now have changed the rhetoric to make the Russians the bad guys. You hear all this talk that Russia is bent on creating the second coming of the Soviet Union. Russia is bent on creating a greater Russia. All right. The Russians are the bad guys. This is a story that was invented after February 22nd, 2014. Nobody was making this argument before February 22nd, 2014. Nobody was arguing that we had to expand NATO to contain Russia before February 22nd, 2014. What happened on February 22nd, 2014 is this cockamamie strategy that we had invented to make Romania, to make Ukraine a part of NATO, blew up in our face. And when it blew up in our face because of our flawed policies, we were not going to admit that we had screwed up. No, we had to blame the Russians. So we said they were bent all along on dominating Eastern Europe. And of course, you hear the same argument made today. It's the Russians who are the bad guys. Putin is really dangerous. We can't negotiate with him. This is the equivalent of Munich, which is another way of saying he's the second coming of Adolf Hitler. And making a deal on Ukraine is like making a deal on Czechoslovakia in October 1938. This is all pure unadulterated nonsense, right? Again, there was no threat from Russia between before February 22nd, 2014. It just wasn't. We invented that story. But anyway, what the ideal situation would be to create a neutral Ukraine, a Ukraine that looked a lot like the Ukraine that existed between 91 and 2014. But we can't do that. And we can't do that in large part because the Americans are unwilling to make any sorts of concessions on NATO expansion. And furthermore, to make neutrality work, to create a neutral Ukraine, it's very important that the Ukrainian government in Kiev reach some sort of modus vivendi with the Russian-speaking population in the Donbass. This is the famous Minsk Accords, right? It's imperative that the Kiev government implement the Minsk Accords so that the civil war, and it is effectively a civil war between the people in Donbass and the people in Western Ukraine, that has to be settled before this problem can be solved. But the politics inside of Ukraine at this point in time make that impossible. And again, as I said, it's impossible to envision President Biden at this point saying that he's going to give up on NATO expansion. So the end result is this crisis is going to go on and on. That's the sad truth, in my humble opinion. So with that, I'll stop talking, Tom, and turn it over to you.
That was great. Super interesting. Thank you, Professor Mearsheimer. You mentioned a few of the key stakeholders in there and a number of key dates and in the lecture that you sent to us to watch beforehand, which I will stick in the chat for anybody who missed it and would like to have a catch up on that. You mentioned again some of the key stakeholders in Europe from west to east: Germany, Poland, Ukraine, Russia, and then outside of Europe, obviously the US and NATO. So I wanted to kick off with a three-part question about some of the other stakeholders. So first, does the UK play any role of importance here? Second, does the European Union play any role of importance here as a set of institutions or as an individual institution? And finally, the United Nations. Some have been asking where Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General, is in all of this. Do you think it matters what he does? So the UK, EU, UN, do they play any role of importance in this situation?
Well, let's talk about the UK first, and we could pick any European country, including Germany and France, as well. The Russians don't want to negotiate with the Germans. They don't want to negotiate with the French, and they don't want to negotiate with the British. because they understand full well that the United States runs the show. And the British will do what the United States asks them to do. So you can have perfunctory conversations with the British, but it really doesn't matter. And that's why the Russians want to talk to the United States. And the Russians don't even want to talk to NATO. They don't want to talk to Stoltenberg. They want to talk to the United States. They want to talk to Joe Biden, because they know that the Europeans basically do what the Americans ask them to do. And if there's any country that does what the Americans ask them to do almost axiomatically, it's Britain. The Germans and the French sometimes resist, as we know from the Iraq War in 2003. But Tony Blair was a mere cheerleader for the United States in that war. So Britain does not have much of a role to play here. The United States is the key player. I don't say that because I'm an American. And indeed, I think American policy is usually so foolish these days that it would be better if the United States had less influence. And it would be better if the Europeans, especially the Germans and the French, stood up to the Americans. With regard to the EU, it's very important to understand that it's not just NATO expansion that is designed to make Ukraine a Western bulwark on Russia's borders. It's NATO expansion, EU expansion, and the color revolution, the orange revolution, the movement to democratize Ukraine. Because you understand, just on the democratic point, the democratization point, the Russians fear that what we will do is then have a color revolution in Russia itself. If you go to Beijing, you go to Moscow. In both places, the leadership lives in fear that the United States will try to foster a color revolution inside China or inside Russia, right? So democratization, EU expansion, and NATO expansion are the three key elements of the strategy, although NATO expansion is the key. So the EU does matter here. There's no question about that, Tom. But the EU is, again, not much of a player. NATO's not much of a player. It's the United States that is driving this train. And let me make one more point on that before I talk about the UN. It's very important to understand that at the April 2008 Bucharest summit, Germany and France were adamantly opposed to any movement to make Ukraine a member of NATO. Because Germany, and here we're talking about Angela Merkel, much to her credit, understood that this was asking for serious trouble. But it was the Americans who, as always, prevailed. And at the end of the Bucharest summit, a statement was issued at the Americans' insistence that said that Ukraine and Georgia would become members of NATO. So the Europeans, and here we're talking about the French and the Germans, they understood that this was a foolish thing to do, but they failed to stand up to the Americans, as is so often the case with the Europeans. Now, finally, you ask about the UN. The UN is effectively useless, and for one very simple reason: the Russians have a veto, right? Anytime there's a dispute between countries that have a vote on the Security Council, and this obviously includes Russia and the United States, the UN is not going to be very meaningful, simply because the Russians would veto anything that they didn't like, and the Americans would veto anything that they didn't like. So this is, bottom line, Tom, a problem that has to be solved by the United States and the Russians.
Sure. Do you think Putin had any intentions over the past few days or weeks, I guess, including months, including the preparations for what has unfolded over the past few days? Do you think he had any intentions of invading Ukraine Or is this all just about embarrassing the West and creating a situation where the narrative can be changed slightly?
My view is that he did not have any intention of invading Ukraine. And he nevertheless understood that there might be circumstances under which that was necessary. For example, I believe if Ukraine was to attack the forces, the Russian supported forces in the Donbass, he would come to their assistance. And that would probably involve a Russian invasion of the eastern part of the country. So I think there's certain scenarios where he might have come in. But I think putting that aside, he had no intention of invading Ukraine. And there are two reasons for that. One are the costs and two, the benefits. Let's just talk about the costs. First of all, if he invaded Ukraine, he'd own it. He'd be an occupier, and that would not work out very well. As he surely knows, when you occupy a country in the modern world, it invariably leads to huge resistance and all sorts of trouble. Putin is surely smart enough to know that invading Ukraine and owning it would be a prescription for huge trouble. Secondly, if he invades Ukraine, we have made it clear in the West that we will go to great lengths to cripple the Russian economy. So there will be significant economic costs in addition to the costs of running an occupation in a huge country filled with people who don't want you there. So those are the costs. Now, what about the benefits of not invading? Putin is winning. I mean, first of all, he's got our attention, right? We're now scrambling to negotiate with him, talk to him, to ameliorate this crisis. Furthermore, we in the West now understand that NATO expansion into Ukraine is viewed by the Russians as an existential threat. So Ukraine is never going to become part of NATO. That's just not going to happen. We now know that. Nobody will say that. And Biden is in no position to back off. But Putin has made it clear where the Russians stand on this. Everybody knows there is a red line in the sand. Furthermore, Putin is doing enormous damage to the Ukrainian economy. He is weakening Ukraine. He is making it less likely that Ukraine will be in a position to launch an offensive against the Donbass, making it less likely that Ukraine will ever be in a position to become a member of NATO. This is why the president of Ukraine is saying to President Biden, please stop talking about an imminent Russian invasion. Because when you do this, you're doing serious damage to the Ukrainian economy, which, as I said before, was a basket case before the crisis. So this crisis has done serious damage to Ukraine, and at the same time has sent a clear message to the West that the present plans of the West to bring Ukraine into NATO are not going to happen. So I think when you marry the cost with how well the strategy is working out, Putin is a winner.
Do you think the West had many other options in terms of how it would respond, even if it made your analysis, which I guess in a lot of cases it probably didn't, but if the intelligence suggested this was just a build-up for the reasons you suggest, was there another option for the West other than also matching the build-up and sending arms to Ukraine, or were they a little bit snookered?
Politically, there was no other option. We were screwed. Yeah. This is a vestige of the unipolar moment, right? We, in 2008, when we were the unipole, we decided to expand NATO. And it blew up in our face in 2014. This is when the unipolar moment is coming to an end. And the problem continues to linger. And we cannot figure out how to solve it without saying that Ukraine will not become part of NATO. And that's politically unacceptable in the West, especially after you've told the story year after year that the Russians are the bad guys and we're the good guys. If the Russians are the bad guys and they're highly aggressive and you believe the Ukrainians have the right to this and the right to that, and you're committed to making sure that they realize these rights, it's almost impossible politically to walk away from this one. It's really quite remarkable. And you want to understand, Tom, that the United States has a deep-seated interest in pivoting to Asia. The United States faces a peer competitor in China. Russia is not a peer competitor. The idea that Russia is some meaningful threat to dominate Europe is a laughable argument, right? We have a deep-seated interest in not getting involved in Eastern Europe and pivoting to East Asia, number one. And number two, we have a deep-seated interest in having Russia as an ally against China. And instead, this foolish policy that we're locked into, and let me underline those words, locked into, this foolish policy is driving the Chinese and the Russians together. We are driving the Russians into the arms of the Chinese. This is a gross violation of balance of power politics 101. So this situation is disastrous for the United States. And I want to be clear here, it's most disastrous for the Ukrainian people, right? You want to understand, we have led the Ukrainian people down the primrose path. They are the ones who are suffering the most as a result of these foolish policies that we pursued during the unipolar moment regarding Russia and Ukraine. And it's now blown up in our face. And the people who will suffer the most, again, I want to emphasize this, are the Ukrainians.
Let's pick up on China a little bit more. You've mentioned about the incompetence of Western leaders in dealing with this kind of security threat. And you've described in the past one root cause of that as being the United States hegemonic status, which has meant that the US has not really been made to pay for its foreign policy mistakes. The US pulls the strings, it can do what it wants because nobody can really touch it. Do you think the rise of China will force the US to tighten its focus and become more pragmatic and realistic in its foreign policy, perhaps including granting more concessions, and that this might actually be a positive thing for the world?
It's not a positive thing for the United States because having a peer competitor is not good. I mean, it was much better to be the unipole. When you're the unipole, you are by definition the only great power on the planet. We now live in a multipolar world where there are two other great powers, Russia, which Putin brought back from the dead, and China, which has grown by leaps and bounds since the early 1990s and is now a peer competitor of the United States. So it would be much better from an American perspective if we were still in the unipolar moment and not in a multipolar world. But to get to the issue that you're raising, Tom, I think there's no question that in unipolarity, the United States is free to pursue all sorts of foolish policies because it doesn't pay a great price. It's usually other countries that pay for America's mistakes. And almost all the wars that we fought in the unipolar moment were unfair fights. It was Bambi versus Godzilla, and we were Godzilla. That world has gone away. And to sort of pick up on your rhetoric, the China threat is going to focus our mind. If the United States gets into a fight with the Chinese over Taiwan or South China or the South China Sea, it's not going to be an unfair fight. China has formidable military capabilities, and those capabilities are growing by the month. So the United States, are going to have our hands full trying to contain China. There's no question about that. And I believe that for structural reasons, given this new threat environment, the United States will behave less foolishly or more wisely than it did during the unipolar moment, where again, it was free to pursue foolish policies because the costs were not very great. The costs associated with containing China are potentially much, much greater. So I believe we will behave in smarter ways vis-a-vis China moving forward. But as I said to you earlier, Tom, you want to remember that the Ukraine crisis is a vestige of the unipolar moment, right? It just sticks in our craw. We can't get rid of it. But it's in our interest. It's in our interest to put an end to the Ukraine crisis, in large part because we want to pivot to Asia.
I'm going to ask one more question and then we'll turn to audience questions. So if anyone has a question they would like to ask, please write it in the chat or stick an X in the chat and you can ask it on screen. Following on from the China threat, do you think the rise of China as a serious peer competitor could be a bit of a turning point that leads to the US taking a more proactive and positive approach towards Russia? Because as you have argued, we need Russia to balance China. Or is it the case that this latest episode and I guess what we've seen before that is just demonstrating that the West is going to continue to be dogmatic about Russia relations and not be particularly proactive in bringing them on side?
Well, I've been arguing for the past couple of years that Russia and the United States would eventually become allies against China. I think, ceteris paribus, China is a greater threat to Russia than the United States is. China and Russia share a border. The United States is separated from Russia by the Atlantic Ocean on one side and the Pacific Ocean on the other side. But the fact is that this crisis over Ukraine really cuts against or contradicts that basic argument that I've been making. And when you marry that fact to the fact that I just said that I didn't see this crisis ending anytime soon because I can't see an off-ramp, that cuts against my point that the United States and China will ultimately come together. Excuse me, the United States and Russia will ultimately come together to try to contain China. So my bottom line is that I still think that at some point in the future, the United States and Russia will be allies against China. But I think I now have to stick the word distant future in there, given the Ukraine crisis, because this new round of trouble between Russia and the West and Russia and the United States has further poisoned relations. And I think, I'm sad to say, I think it makes it tougher than ever to see how we can get out of this situation.
Okay. Thank you for that. I'm going to hand over to Naman, who I think has a question for you. We can't hear you, Naman. try again.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, perfect.
Apologies for that. I'm curious to what extent the logic of Ukraine being a neutral zone or buffer state can be applied to Southeast Asia vis-a-vis China, and whether or not the same breathing space can be established there.
Well, one can argue that it's hard to have buffer states between great powers because each great power has a vested interest in turning that buffer state into an ally or even conquering it. This is why a country like Poland, which used to be sandwiched between Germany or Prussia and Russia or the Soviet Union and Austria, disappeared from the map on numerous occasions. Poland had terrible geography because it was sandwiched in between these great powers. But if you think about Ukraine today, Naaman, there's no great power on the left-hand side of Ukraine. There is a great power, Russia, on one side. But if you take away the United States and NATO expansion, there's no threat to Ukraine. There's no great power threatening Ukraine on its left-hand side. And Russia, as I said, has no interest in conquering Ukraine and doesn't have to worry much about Ukraine for strategic reasons in the absence of NATO expansion. So you take NATO expansion away, Ukraine can easily remain a buffer state. If you go to East Asia, the question is, what countries look like buffer states? And I don't see any buffer states out there. And the reason is that the potential points of conflict in East Asia involve the South China Sea, Taiwan, and the East China Sea, especially these rocks in the East China Sea that the Japanese say belong to them and the Chinese say belong to them. Instead of having buffer states with regard to those three flashpoints, you have water. You have the South China Sea, no buffer state, it's all about water. You have Taiwan, the buffer between Taiwan and mainland China is water. And then you have these rocks in the East China Sea where the buffer between them and Japan and them and China is water. Okay. But you could argue that if you look at Taiwan, you look at these islands or islets in the South China Sea, and you look at the rocks in the East China Sea, that both sides, both the Chinese side and the American-led side, have a vested interest in controlling those pieces of territory in the same way that the great powers had a vested interest in controlling Poland in the past. In other words, think about Taiwan. The United States and Japan, and now Australia, they want to keep Taiwan on our side of the ledger. The Chinese want Taiwan back, not only because it's sacred territory to them, but also because it has important strategic value. So you can see, in response to your question, that if you look at East Asia and you look at how the Americans, the Japanese, and the Australians on one hand think about Taiwan, and you look at how the Chinese think about Taiwan, it's important strategic real estate that they both have their eye on for good security-related reasons. And that's not unlike Poland in the past. And excuse me, it's not unlike Ukraine in a world where a NATO alliance moves to incorporate Ukraine into NATO. But the general point here is that great powers worry greatly about their security. They tend to be paranoid. And any smaller country that lives in the neighborhood of a great power should be extremely careful not to anger any of its great power neighbors, because those great power neighbors are likely then to do terrible things to them.
Great. Thanks for the question, Norman. I'm going to ask a question now from the chat from Daniel, which is there any truth to Russia's claims that in the 1990s, NATO promised not to expand further to the east?
This is a fascinating question. The fact is that when the Cold War ended, the Soviet Union and the United States and the West Germans had a series of discussions on this very issue. And there is all sorts of evidence that the West promised not to expand NATO eastward. But nothing was written down. The Soviets did not get a written guarantee. What that means is that everybody is free to interpret what was said verbally as they see fit. And therefore, you have a number of people who argue that it's clear that NATO, and here we're talking mainly about the United States, said that there would be no expansion. And you have a number of people in the West who say no such agreement was made. And they point to different documents and different comments that people make. But there's no written document that serves as an agreement. And therefore, the West has been pretty much free to do whatever it wanted in that regard. And of course, the Russians have screamed bloody murder from the get-go. When it became clear in the mid-1990s that the Clinton administration was bent on NATO expansion, the Russians made it unequivocally clear, and this includes Boris Yeltsin, who was a close friend to Bill Clinton's, that NATO expansion was unacceptable to the Russians. We did it anyway. And in 1999, you had the first tranche. In 2004, you had the second tranche. And then in 2008, you had the Bucharest summit. We just would not listen to the Russians. We just ignored them and we just kept marching eastward. And as I said in my formal comments, we got away with it twice. We got away with it in 99. We got away with it in 2004. But after 2008, it blew up in our face.
That was Professor John Mearsheimer, who teaches at the University of Chicago. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time in your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll be with you again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
You're listening to WGRN 94.1, Columbus Community Radio, the Green Renaissance.